Okay. Sorry. Well, welcome. Good morning. Good morning. Hi, everyone. Yes, it's like a teacher kind of situation here. Thank you. So, lesson one. We all carry a piece of the internet in our pockets, right? Cell phones and other smartphones and things like that. And we're going to talk about the internet. And we all dream about the internet stopping working for a week, so no email, no spam, nothing for a week. Let's make it not work, at least for that piece, for the next 90 minutes. Turn off the phones. Seriously, turn them off. Yesterday, the moderator mentioned it 3 times, and there were still were phones ringing, so turn them off, please. So I'm Bruno Giussani. I'm the European Director of the TED Conferences. I'll be the host. I'm not the one speaking. They will be giving you all the information and insights that you are expecting from this session. But just as a matter of framing it a little bit, personal and social connectivity is not something exactly new. We have discussed here at Scholl already in the last few years. What I think is really new is that the reach of the internet, and let's include also cell phones in that, has become such that now this is something inclusionary and no longer exclusionary. More than half of the population in the world actually have some form of access to this kind of connectivity. Let's call it social connectivity in general, networks. So we're starting to see a different kind of reality where the majority of people in the world are included in this. And when we have a phenomenon of this scale, it changes many things. It changes the world in which we live in many ways. The description of this session says everyone is a co-creator, a witness, a reporter, an educator, and more. But it also creates a world where everywhere where something serious and important happens, it's very likely there is a camera ready to capture that moment, and it's very likely there's a network ready to or able to pass on that information to the rest of the world, which means that, for example, things like human rights abuses are no longer so easy to conceal, and the classic example is witness.org. It creates a world where data can be aggregated at a massive scale, and therefore it changes the way we can read reality and understand reality, things just that initiatives like Ushahidi and all the role it has been playing in different situations, election transparency, crisis management, and so on. It creates a world where the best teachers can now be seen by millions around the world. That's our own case and case of many others. When we distribute lectures and speeches online. So this kind of social connectivity can be used in many different ways, for information, for organization, for finding partners and other people to work with, to channel financing, which is also something rather important for this crowd and the things we do. And this session wants to discuss some of these issues with three panelists, speakers. Mona El-Tahawi is a Middle East writer and public speaker. Liu Yan is a Chinese digital culture animator, let's call her like that. She's an entrepreneur and an expert on the issue. And Joe Ito is the CEO of Creative Commons, among many other things. I will introduce them one by one. And the format is the following. Each of them will give an 8-9 minutes talk on a specific issue. And then after the three, we will come back to a general discussion, and we will bring in during the discussion a couple of other points of view and examples of other kind of activities that are done and developed using social networks. So, phones are off. Thank you. I hope that. First is Mona. Mona El-Tahawi. She's a writer on Arab and Muslim issues, particularly when they relate to women. She is based in New York, but she's been living in Egypt, in Saudi Arabia, in Israel. And we've asked her to talk about the ways networks are empowering people in the region, in the Middle East. Many of us know well things like the role of Twitter and blogs during the Iranian situation, for example, last year. But I'm pretty sure that most of us don't know of other kind of usages of these tools in the region. So, Mona.
Thank you, Bruno. morning, everyone. Can everybody hear me? Okay, I'm feeling like I'm a bit low here, so I'm going to talk extra loud. As Bruno said, I'm from the Middle East. I'm a Muslim. I'm a feminist, an often explosive combination. But one which I would like to talk in or share ideas with you and wonderful discoveries I found from the Middle East about how women especially, are using the internet and social networking to get their voice out. Now, we often hear that the internet has given a voice to the voiceless, and because I had planned to speak about women today, it was quite, it was serendipity that yesterday, during the reception, someone asked me why my grandfather allowed or had approved of the genital cutting of my mother and my aunts, even though he was a judge and an educated man. And a man standing next to me who works in this field jumped in and answered for me. And I thought, wow, so this is what it's like to have your voice co-opted, because it's never happened to me before. I'm an opinion writer. It's very difficult to get me to shut up. So this is exactly why this is so important, because even the most well-meaning people who want to go out there and help often end up speaking for those who can speak for themselves. And this is where the internet has come out and allowed them to speak for themselves. As I discovered last night, that is a wonderful thing. My first experience with the Saudi part of the internet especially was extremely delightful for me, because I spent 6 very difficult years. I'm going to stand up. I feel like a little person. I spent 6 really difficult years in Saudi Arabia, and so to discover women online in Saudi Arabia was just wonderful. And my first experience with those blogs was with a blog called Saudi Girl. And Saudi Girl described herself as a young, liberated, unconservatized Saudi woman whose dream was to go and vote one day. As we all know, nobody votes in Saudi, but men started to vote somewhat, but women don't vote in Saudi Arabia. So I introduced her at a conference at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. in 2005 at a press conference generally, but it was news and just a general conference on the Arab media. And I was telling all these policy wonks and think tank types and diplomats, you have to go follow Saudi Girl blog. And then 2 years later, when I was writing an essay on blogging in the Middle East, I went to see how Saudi Girl was doing. And much to my surprise and delight, Saudi Girl turned out to be a Saudi boy. It was a Saudi man pretending to be a Saudi woman, because he wanted his fellow Saudis to understand what it's like to be a Saudi woman. And I'll just read the first 2 lines of his coming out, where he says, epilogue, l'agent provocateur. He says, yes, this poem is terminated. The truth, Saudi Girl was literally was a literal experiment, an instance of rhetorical transvestism. If you think, this is a Saudi man. If you think of writers like George Eliot, you know, women who used to pretend to be men, here we have the very opposite. And this is what is the beauty that lies at the heart of the internet for me, because it's basically cultural and artistic dissidents who are using the internet to subvert authorities of various kinds in the Middle East. And you see it, and the chains just kind of go out, and the networking goes out, where women who have never had a chance to meet and whose issues and rights that are violated and whose voices are often silenced in many ways have suddenly discovered this wonderful network that gives them strength in numbers, but that also helps them to organize. And so from Saudi Girl, I was then able to discover other wonderful women on the internet. I'm going to run this video without audio, because you really don't need the audio. It's all about the picture. And you'll see this is a Saudi activist called Wajiha Al-Huwaidar. What is she doing? She's driving a car. Where? In Saudi Arabia, where it's illegal to drive a car. Hold on, let me just shut the sound down. And she did this on International Women's Day. She got her sister-in-law to sit next to her in the car and film her driving as she narrates an open letter to the Saudi Minister of the Interior saying, dear Mr. Minister, as you can see, I am driving. I have a driver's license because I got it in the US, but I urge you to lift the ban on women driving, because there are hundreds of women in Saudi Arabia who know how to drive, and we are willing to teach our Saudi sisters how to drive if you give us the chance. So, and hence this, she wasn't arrested. She has been in the past detained, and she's had her passport taken. So what protected her this time from being arrested? YouTube. Exposure. The fact that I know that she did this, the fact that CNN showed that she did this, and again, this idea of safety in numbers, because she used this video to start a petition. She posted the petition on Facebook. She sent it by email. They set up internet groups and listservs, and this YouTube video now has been downloaded and watched hundreds of thousands of times. Then we jump now from Wajiha al-Huwaidar to another Saudi activist. And this is, again, by way of just this wonderful connectivity that happens online, to one of my favorite bloggers, a Saudi woman again. She's called her blog is called Saudi Woman's Blog, and she has never met Wajiha al-Huwaidar, who's quite a controversial figure, as you can imagine, in Saudi Arabia. But yet she devoted a whole page on her in her blog to her, again by way of kind of creating this further ripple so that other Saudis and other non-Saudis understand what Saudi women are doing, because one of the main aims of her blog isn't just to connect to other Saudi women, but to show, because I'm always asked when I speak on campuses, especially in the US, why should I care about Saudi women? What are they doing to help themselves? You know, and it's all these stereotypes of Muslim women. But here is a Muslim woman showing that other Muslim women are fighting for their rights and trying to connect and create this network of for other Muslim women to see how they can use the internet and spread the message out further. I only have 5 minutes left because this is all very quick, but this is, I want to show you another woman, another Saudi, called Arish Khan, who's only, I think, 24. And what she did was she set up this wonderful website called Nahnu, which means literally in Arabic, we the women. And what she does with this website is that she creates these bubbles, you'll see them here, and she encourages Saudi men and women to print these bubbles and write why they think women should or shouldn't drive and post them around various Saudi cities. So you'll see this one here. Someone said, I don't like the back seat. And then she encourages them to take a picture and then post it back on her blog so they start this conversation together, whether they agree or disagree about Saudi women driving. So this is in Saudi, and I give I focus a lot on Saudi because it's often taken as the most repressive country when it comes to women's rights. If we go to a country that has, you know, many more rights, but depending on who you are in that country, Lebanon, I take you to a group that started a campaign to get Lebanese women citizenship rights. In many parts of the Arab world, women cannot pass on their citizenship to their husbands and their children. And so a campaign was launched that again connects all these different aspects of the internet called, it's called My Citizenship, My Right to Hand to Pass on Citizenship to My Children and Husband. And the woman in charge of this is now using Facebook, but also her own blog and her connections with groups like Women's Learning Partnership. And whenever they have demonstrations in Beirut, they post information on the Facebook group and on Women's Learning Partnership and encourage Lebanese women around the world to hold cyber demonstrations and to visit and to hold demonstrations in the real world outside various Lebanese embassies around the world. And this campaign is actually coming to a head now because there's a very, very famous case that will go to the appeals court in Beirut where a woman has appealed to give citizenship to her husband, to the children of a foreign-born husband. That's for citizenship campaigns. If I can take you to a more perhaps extreme example, especially when it comes to the Arab world, lesbian and bisexual rights. And again, this is in Lebanon. There's a wonderful group called MEME. And they launched, they're a splinter group of the first gay and lesbian organization in the Middle East called Helm, based in Beirut. And what MEME did was they got fed up of always having to sit next to the men because, as we all know, the men love to talk for us. So they said, well, let's just split off and just focus on women's issues. So they formed MEME, which comes from the first letter, the Arabic letter MEME, from the word same-sex, which is a very new introduction to the Arabic lexicon because we didn't have a word in Arabic that was not derogatory to mean same-sex. And so now MEME comes from the word mithli, which means same sex. So this organization, what it does, if you see this the community side here on the left-hand side, they explain what MEME is, they tell women how to contact MEME, and because they face incredible danger, they're all anonymous, and for a woman, a lesbian, bisexual, or transgender person in Lebanon to contact them, they have to first send them an email, and then they're arranged to have coffee, and then they'll, you know, try to figure out if this person is genuine or not, and if they are and they trust them, then they allow them into their community, and then all the services available are then available to this person. So they can have counseling, they can go to a safe house if they're physically in danger, and where they also crisscross into the real world is, they published a book last June, and I was incredibly privileged to be at the book launch of oral narratives of lesbian, bisexual women in Lebanon and a transgendered, where in no other Arab capital would you have seen this, two lesbian Lebanese women were on stage reading from the book in English and in Arabic to give voice again to a community that we never hear from. So this is MEME. And then I want to show you one last slide from them that that explains how the connections go out beyond the internet. Very simply, they have one of the links on the page where they ask how you can support us. And I'll end on this positive note. Send an encouraging email. A few kind words can go a long way. Never underestimate the power of moral support. Moral support is what got us here. Moral support and the internet, because I assign this website to my students when I teach about how women use new media. And when they interviewed me anonymously, but I know who they are, so I trust them, they said, we exist because of the internet. We exist online. And it is exactly this crisscrossing between the virtual world and the real world that has allowed all these women, be they Saudi men pretending to be women, be they Lebanese women fighting for citizenship or sexual rights, to connect with each other, to connect with NGOs that help them, but most importantly, to connect with women who never knew that there were others out there like them and who always felt other people were speaking for them. And this is truly the beauty of the internet and the power of networking that it has given women in the Middle East. Thank you.
Thank you, Mona. Are there any urgent questions for Mona? Let me come back to this. So keep your questions noted, but if there is some point that you want to make absolutely right now, wait for a microphone to come, please. Just because we are recording, so we need your voice through the microphone. And please introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Matt York. I had a question, Mona. So you just fleetingly referenced an informal process where women need to vet one another to confirm that it's another woman they can trust. Is there some way to leverage an internet application to do that?
No, some creative mind in this room, please create one. No, they do that in the real world. It's kind of like, you know, if you meet someone on an internet dating site and they say meet them in a public place because it's safe, that's how they do it. Mm-hmm. So they meet you in a coffee shop and, you know, I mean, they have examples of incredibly ugly hate mail that they post online to show you what it's like. So it's very dangerous. But they do it the old-fashioned way, face-to-face. If someone can create this application, I'm sure they would love it.
There's probably some way to validate the legitimacy of someone's identity, but enough for now.
Okay. Any other point? No. But I have one. Can you give us some figures? Give us a sense of how big this is, because the examples are incredibly telling.
Yes.
And incredibly advanced, but
yes.
How big is this?
In terms of how many people use the
internet?
In terms of
general numbers and impact, are we talking about, you know, 15 bloggers or 15,000?
Yes. Oh, no. According to the Berkman Center, and this was a report that they published, I think, last year, there are something like 40,000 blogs in the Middle East. And in a country like Saudi Arabia, at least half, if not more, of the bloggers are women. So you're talking, and Saudi Arabia and the Gulf is where that region is that has the highest internet penetration rate because they're quite affluent. So if you're talking about half of Saudi bloggers being women, that's a big reach.
And I have one data point as well. So Facebook is blocked in Syria, but according to Alexa, it's the third most popular site. And they'll always figure out a way to get there.
Exactly.
Okay, we'll come back to many, many things around this later, but let's move to another region. So from the Middle East to China, which is also a very hot region in terms of the internet right now. Liu Yan is a defined before as a digital culture animator because she has so many different hats, entrepreneur and writer and others. But she's the CEO of a collaborative workspace called Jindanwei, which is a space where creators and innovators can gather and work together on different projects. And this points to a very specific problem in places like China, which is there is no infrastructure in place to support social entrepreneurs. And therefore, social networks become the alternative, and these kind of spaces become the surrogate infrastructure to support them. So, Vivian.
Thank you, Bruno. I'm here today to show you some examples of how Chinese social entrepreneurs are using social media tools and technology to establish network and become scalable and creating social impact. I believe they're inspiring both for people who know about China or who are not familiar about China. What is the situation in China right now? The Chinese government's reform on small governments and big societies is taking place. And there is a great demand from community and individuals for social needs. Meanwhile, businesses are starting to get involved in creating public goods and social initiatives. And there is a huge need for social capital building. However, we're facing a huge amount of difficulties to achieve our goals because the development of third sector in China is still in its very early stage. And we don't have an environment that nurture and support social initiatives. Very often, we must cope with many restrictions and bureaucratic confinements to be able to keep ourselves alive. In this kind of context, many of our peer entrepreneurs don't have access to the opportunity and to leverage their skill, capacity, and build up innovation spirit. Well, luckily we're a big country with a lot of good people, so that's why I'm here today to actually share with you a few good examples. This is my organization, Xindang Wei. It literally means new work unit. Work unit is an old term in communist regime. Well, we're still in communist regime, but it's slightly different. It is more like a sort of new work community. It is an online and offline social network service to promote and facilitate creativity, sharing, and great skill of collaboration among social entrepreneurs and people who want to make a change. Xindang Wei's model is a merge of online social network and physical workspaces. While xindangwei.com is using cloud computing technology to provide real-time online communication, including file sharing and wikis, to increase collaboration efficiency for its members. Xindang Wei workspaces offer member full facility to work and to meet people, to host user-generated events, offline events, and public activities, and to catalyze some very good innovative projects. Well, it is free to become Xindang Wei member, online member, sorry. And it costs $1.50 per person per hour to rent an office or a conference room. Above all, a Xindang Wei membership is evaluated and adjusted based on the value of each member's contributions and interaction in the community. The returns are a kind of digital currency called share, and it can be cashable and traded inside and outside Xindang Wei community. Here's another good example. I like it very much. It is an online community of translators connected through Web 2.0 tools who discover, translate, and read the best of the web from English to Chinese to ensure people who don't speak English could have access to some useful and crucial knowledge available on the web. It uses a wiki platform to allow co-translation and allow others to co-edit the content. And it's a very smart way of doing that. It has segmented the translator by interest and top group, so you know exactly what kind of field they're good at in. Right now, Yiyan is crowdsourced by 20 local publishers and foreign content holders like Guardian and Telegraph to translate their content from English to Chinese. And translators get rewarded from the book sales and advertising sales, which is very different from traditional way of paying the translator. It costs like about a half dollar per 1,000 Chinese characters. That's a traditional way. What the impact is, right now they have 150 users of the website, 15,000 translators, and 500 projects going on simultaneously. The third example Qifang. It is a web service for Chinese students to find a way to pay for their education by connecting them with individuals, companies, and organizations that can support their educational dreams. Working like a sort of eBay auction, sponsors bid and compete to help and lend. A lender can offer internships or job opportunities, as well as providing funding to pay bills. Qifang manages the transaction and repayment, and is a communication tool for borrowers, lenders, and peers. Well, students can also learn about financial literacy. Well, the impact of Qifang is they are now operating 3,000 loans, over $1 million, and 96% repayment rate. The fourth example, 1kg. It is a sort of open sourcing tourism charity organization. Its aim is actually to build and optimize online community of young travelers, sort of backpackers, to the rural areas. Not just by sending them to explore the nature, but to encourage these young backpackers to carry 1 kilo more stuff, such as books and toys, to the rural area to give them to the children there. It has an online wiki database for community to share their rural school information and their trip experiences, and co-design solutions and services for these schools. Well, currently, they have about 25,000 users. Nearly 1,000 schools are in the database, and they know exactly what the school needs, from what kind of support they need. Well, in China, we have nearly 400 million internet users. Internet technology has allowed us to give everyone accessibility to do something good collectively. It is easy, it is simple, it can be done on a daily basis. And it is transparent and has immediate gains, and you can always keep your right. As a result, these minor behaviors, actions, could generate a snowball effect and a huge impact. It has made more small voices being heard and has helped the organization and society to reach a higher level of intelligence and social capital accumulation. Well, meanwhile, these networks and sharing are not so easy in China because we have to face a lot of issues like internet censorship, propaganda, and all kinds of obligations. But despite all the obstacles, we're still working hard to get more connected. To name just a few, Social Innovation China is an event on 24th April in Xindan Wei for and by social entrepreneurs. It is a platform to network, exchange ideas, explore collaboration, and get things done. And we're also working together to start an Entrepreneur Commons chapter in Xindan Wei as well, dedicated to help Chinese entrepreneurs through peer support groups. And this gathering actually takes place once a month, and entrepreneurs could share ideas and knowledge and contacts in a close, trusted environment. And the chapter is also a kind of pipeline from which entrepreneurs collaborate to select mature projects that will become eligible for funding. Well, we believe only if we could connect our network with one another and share our knowledge with our peers within the country on a global level, it is possible for us to win the trust and build a consensus with the government and influence the policy and funding infrastructure. Therefore, make China a more civilized society and bring change to the world. I thank you for your attention. I hope to share more with you in the future.
Lilian, thank you. Any urgent question or remark? Okay, it's for later. Yeah? Can we get the mic up here at the top? Raise your hand so she can see you.
Wonderful presentation, thank you. About a week ago, on your point about censorship being an obstacle in China, there was a news release about a lot of Chinese internet users spoofed their IP address, basically allowed them to get by the censorship and access their Twitter accounts. How widespread is this practice, and how much desire is there locally for internet users to really get to content that's normally censored in China?
Do you mean the Twitter users, how they actually get connected? Joy just mentioned, Facebook, Twitter, part of the Flickr, most of the social media tools actually are blocked in China, but we're using it every day on a daily basis. There is always a way to get around, and we even host a workshop to tell people how to install the VPN. And in Chinese, we call it fanqiang, it's a wall climbing sort of practice that everybody must master if they want to share.
We'll come back to that because I think Joy has some points about exactly that issue, not only related to China. So Joy Hito is our third speaker and panelist. He also has a very long bio. Let's just say that he's the CEO of Creative Commons, which is a very important piece of what we're trying to develop with the internet. He's also a member of the board of the Mozilla Foundation, of Regions.org and Global Voices. So three big organizations trying to bridge different sorts of gaps. He's an entrepreneur and many other things. And he has a global view because he's from Japan, lives in Dubai part of the time, works in the US and in Europe. So the global view from Joy Hito, and a look at the risks involved with this. Joy.
Thank you, Bruno. I wanted to first sort of frame the conversation a little bit and tie it into some of the stuff from the previous session about social media. I think it's important to remember why we're doing it and the fact that social media isn't just a tool to continue to do what you used to do. You have to change your behavior in order for you to understand how this impacts you. And I think one of the key things is this. So there's a book recently, and I'm not an author. I'm just plugging it partially because I'm in it, but it's a great book. it's called The Power of Pull. It's by Johns Lee Brown, John Hagel, and Lang. And it's the general idea is that it used to be that you used to stock knowledge, you used to stock stuff, and you would push it out through your hierarchy. And it was about having assets and stuff. And now in the network, what you're doing is they're calling it pull. So what you do is when you need stuff, you pull it from your network. It's kind of like just-in-time manufacturing. So instead of having lots and lots of lists of contacts or lots and lots of knowledge, what you do is you get the knowledge when you need it. It's like searching for Google. It's like having a Facebook group when you need it. It's about reaching out and getting the people when you need them. And the reason why social media works well is because it's just that. It's just-in-time. It's being able to pull the people together when you need them, but not having to have to maintain them as staff and maintain them. And so if you're thinking about it from a social entrepreneur's perspective, it's having fewer full-time equivalents on your payroll, but having a lot more volunteers and not having to maintain them all on an ongoing basis, but pull them in as you need them. And the recommendation that they have is to have a vision, to have a trajectory. I want to go in this direction and use the networks and move forward. But one key thing that they say, which I love, is you have to allow serendipity to happen and embrace it. And use that serendipity positively. Because people who plan everything, they don't have luck. Because luck doesn't happen when everything is planned. And I think Edward Hall has this great book called Beyond Culture, where he talks about polychronic and monochronic societies. Polychronic societies are like the Middle East, you know, or parts of Latin America, where everything is chaotic and everything happens at the same time, and you just kind of talk to the people you feel like talking to. That's what social networking is a lot like. You never forget your context in those situations because everything is serendipitous. In Western culture, everything is monochronic. Time and space is delineated. You have meetings, ends of meetings. You have agendas. You have cubicles. And everything is planned and very scalable, but you completely forget why you're doing it in the first place, right? And so you have to think about social media as this kind of polychronic mode, which is highly contextual and very much pull rather than push. And unless you redesign your organization, your thinking, you're never going to really get your head around how this actually helps. And so a couple of things. When you create this network, you have to make connections, right? And so the whole point of this network is to make connections with the right people and not connect with the wrong people. one of the things that we talked about was censorship. And I'm going to skip over a lot of this stuff because I know that we have different levels of technical skill. And there's a great social network site called the Skoll Pathable site. And if you go to the page for this session, I posted all the links to a lot of the stuff that I'm talking about and the guidebooks on how to do some of this stuff. There's a great project at the Berkman Center called Herdic. It's an add-on that you can download to. It's a plugin for Firefox, and what it does is it tracks it. Whenever you get a site that's blocked, you can report it. And if you go to the site, you can see all the different sites and which countries it's blocked in, and it feeds into an annual report of all the websites that are blocked. And then you can actually and the Berkman Center and different people are working on it. But this is a very important project on censorship, and we can talk more about censorship later. Copyright is actually really important in various ways, and this is one of my main roles, is working on copyright, because I think people don't realize that copyright is one of the big hurdles. It's what causes lawyers to get introduced into the system. And lawyers in sharing is like sand and Vaseline. It really is a failure of the system. And one of the really important things is open source. If you go to a lot of these developing areas, you see Oracle and Microsoft and Cisco doing really great things, teaching people how to think about code, how to use IT. But to me, and I love them for doing a lot of this stuff, but at the end of the day, they're still selling those Terminator seeds that Monsanto used to sell, which is basically making you addicted to code that you have to continue to buy, you have to continue to license. And the American government uses the embassies of Jordan and all these other places to enforce copyright and throw kids in jail for copying Microsoft Word to run these things. So the key for enabling a lot of this stuff is open source. And one of the problems is the open source community doesn't have the funding to go around and teach people how to write code. So one of the big disasters is you see all these wonderful startups in the Middle East and they all run .NET. You know, and so one of the things that we're doing at the Mozilla Foundation is we have a project called Drumbeat, which we're trying to go around and help give little micro grants to bar camps and different kinds of little meetups so that we can start teaching people to embrace open source and embrace code that they own and they write. Because that's, and the parallel really is really important to make with the development. It's teaching people how to recreate more of their own stuff rather than get addicted to IT that they have to buy from the West. And Creative Commons, I'm not going to go into detail on this. This is the main organization that I represent. But the idea that we have is it's like open source for content. We create copyright licenses that allow open content to be shared freely and to be interoperable. So our users are TED's videos are licensed under Creative Commons license. Al Jazeera has posted a bunch of their stuff under Creative Commons license. The White House uses a Creative Commons license for third-party content that gets uploaded because they want to allow people to share. And Wikipedia uses our licenses, and we can talk more about this. But the key is that if you don't use a Creative Commons license, if somebody wants to use your work, you often will probably require to have a lawyer create a contract that's friction. And also it creates bodies of work that aren't interoperable. It's like having three internets instead of one. And I realize that's really confusing, but I'll describe it if people are more interested. And the language barrier is huge, and there's a bunch of different initiatives to try to solve the language barrier thing. One is Creative Commons, because if I post a blog post under a Creative Commons license, I often see it translated into dozens of languages by the time I'm up the next day, because Creative Commons license allows people to create a derivative work, which translation is, without asking permission. If you don't have a Creative Commons license, they have to ask permission, and that's usually a barrier to doing that. Yen, you already described. Midan is an Arabic license, Arabic translation service that uses machine translation and then humans on top of that. Wikipedia has a really interesting translation community. We need more people to be involved in that. Global Voices is another organization that I'm involved in, and they have regional editors that pick stuff up, and then they do lots of cross-translation. They built a platform for it. It's actually really interesting, and we're happy to share. But it's really interesting, for instance, watching the Arab blogs translated into English responding to the Iranians protesting the election and saying, how can we Arabs be sitting on our butts when we don't have any, when our brothers over in Iran are doing this. And listening to this in multiple languages is very interesting. And then the last section is just some of the scary stuff, which is first of all, the bad guys are winning. And one of the things I want everybody to sort of, this is a sort of a sober moment. I mean, if you read the New York Times article from John Markoff recently, recently hackers have gotten all of years of the Dalai Lama's email. They have broken, basically, if with a concerted effort, the hackers can break into anything. And so you just have to be aware and be mindful about that. The other thing is, Witness is another organization that I'm involved in. Yvette's here, I think. But the other thing that you have to be mindful of is when you post things like videos of human rights abuses, you have to be mindful about those victims. You might want to think about mosaicing. There's a bunch of people who are talking about best practices around human rights videos and sharing them, and so I encourage people to participate in that conversation. Tor is a really great tool, and there's a handbook on how to use Tor on the website. Tor is a way to anonymize your access. So, for instance, if you connect to a Tor network, it jumbles your network, your traffic across, and then it pops you out on the other side. So government tracing, you can see that you're connecting to the Tor network, but they can't tell what you're saying, and they can't tell what you're accessing. So, for instance, if you wanted to create an anonymous blog, you could go through Tor, create a Gmail account, create a WordPress account, and create a blog that a government would never know was being created by you. They would just know you're doing something suspicious because you're using Tor. But otherwise, it allows, Tor originally comes from the naval intelligence community and is probably the most robust anonymous browsing tool, and it's pretty easy to use. And again, Global Voices has created a handbook, which I posted on how to do anonymous blogging. And finally, there's a bunch of tools and organizations on creating your own organization. The net's a great place. I think a lot of people stumble on things like how do you create nonprofits, how do you do lots of technology. One of the organizations is one-click orgs. They're trying to create a whole bunch of templates that you can go online and do one click, and it'll create articles of incorporation and minutes and agendas and stuff like that. So a lot of the processes about doing the sort of nuts and bolts of the legal stuff is they're trying to codify. Guy's name's Charles Arnstrom. If you give me things that you would like to see templates for, they'll do it, and we're starting to share knowledge across organizations, especially creating charities and nonprofits globally is a really tricky thing, and so we're trying to share. And then finally, there's a thing called hackerspaces, which are popping up all over the place, and there's hackerspaces.org. And these are originally just a bunch of hackers that create co-working spaces, but as hackers, they've realized that they want to share all this stuff, so they've created patterns, they've created technologies, and there's a network of networks. And just about every city has a hackerspace. And what's interesting is a lot of these hackers are starting to become very socially sort of responsible and interested in being involved in social entrepreneurship. So there's actually a really interesting synergy. And so if you don't have the technology, I urge you to look for the hackerspace in your region. You can find them all linked from hackerspaces.org and talk to them and go in and give a talk, do a brown bag lunch, and you can often recruit some really great hackers. And this network also has its own network of connections across the world. And this is really a thing that's just emerged in the last couple of years, and it's a really powerful network that I urge you to tap into. And that's my time's up. Thank you.
Thank you, Joy. Okay, I have a lot of questions for them, but your questions have priority. So let's see if anybody wants to react to any of the three talks and ask questions, add experiences, ideas. Yes, here. Please identify yourself and be brief.
Thank you. Mauricio Vivero with the Seattle International Foundation, and I have a question for Mona. We currently support the women's movement in Nicaragua and Guatemala and other countries in Central America, and want to support their use of social media to really advance the women's movement, especially among indigenous women. Given all the choices and possibilities and websites and blogs, what lessons can you share with us about things you've learned to support these movements using social media and perhaps mistakes we could avoid?
To see it all as part of another network that goes beyond the internet, because, and this ties into what Bruno was asking earlier about how many blogs are there and how connected people are really. See it as part of kind of many concentric circles that connect. So mobile phone usage, for example, in areas where there isn't a lot of connectivity online connectivity is very important. So making sure people have access to a mobile phone because that connects you to others who are online. Anonymity is very important. I mean, I love the Saudi girl, Saudi boy example, but it's also an example of the kind of pitfalls that you can fall into. If anonymity both protects, but anonymity can also be used, you know, for more harmful purposes. So being careful as to, you know, who goes on. I often watch on Facebook groups and blogs. The bloggers know each other and they know who to trust, but they will say, you know, be careful because so-and-so sounds like a government agent. So what, appreciating that anonymity is both positive and negative. And I think also for a lot of people, especially those who don't know, who are not very familiar with the internet. I mean, you mentioned women, especially disadvantaged women and communities that are not so connected, just basic lessons on how easy it is to create a blog or a note on Facebook. And how anyone can open something that can, you know, that starts speaking for them. Because you're talking about the most marginalized groups. That's what the beauty of what all these women's groups are doing. These are groups who have been marginalized by everyone, be they religious leaders, social leaders, or political leaders. So just giving them that idea that they can get their voice out, either mobile phones, internet, blogs. And I would love to talk to you more about how, you know, the kind of lessons you use and share experience. Sounds great, what you do.
There were a question. Two questions here, and then we come to you. Yes.
Hi, my name's Elmira Birasli. I work for a nonprofit called Endeavor. And just picking up on this point about mobile communications, and I love, Joy, thanks for sharing all that information about how to kind of trump the censors. Because the one thing that I think we all here, I think all agree on, is that we want the people, whether they're in the Middle East or in China or in Iran, to have a bigger voice. But how can the developers, the people who actually create the technologies, enable that? And here what I'm specifically speaking of is women in the Middle East can get access to cell phones or the internet, but what about those women who are being monitored? How can we tell the developers in Silicon Valley or in the West to create devices that will enable them to keep continuing to do what they're doing? So it's not just about encouraging them to get their voices out, but what can we in the West do when we're developing these technologies, understand what their life situation is?
Can I give one anecdote, which isn't generalizable necessarily, but very important, is so Dan Kaminsky, who is the guy who found one of the critical flaws in the internet recently, he created a tool that allowed you to upload or post to Twitter without being caught by the censors in Iran. But what we decided, he was going to post it all online, but we convinced him to not do that. And then I talked to Human Rights Watch, our Global Voices folks, and Witness. We found all the people who knew people on the ground. We created a package that made it so that we would never know who was going to use it. We wouldn't monitor anything. And then we translated it into Farsi, and we put it in a paper, sort of digital, sort of sneaker net form. And then we gave it to people who we didn't know, and then we passed it on, and it ended up in the field. And the point was that I think a lot of the geeks in Silicon Valley want to get credit for it. They want to know how many people used it. But all that's really, really bad, because it's stuff that gets traced back to you. And then when in this book they wanted to tell a story, I had the Human Rights Watch people actually go through and edit everything, because in the trials right now against the activists in Iran, what they're doing is they're reading blog posts and articles about, you know, well-meaning people saying, I helped the activists in Iran, and they say, okay, so you've been collaborating with the Americans, you're going to jail, right? And so we had to be very careful about saying we are providing tools to help free speech and stuff like that. And so there's a lot of sensitivity when you help somebody. And so there's another case when the Ford Foundation funded a project for communication, I think it was in Lebanon, and everybody said it was CIA money, you know, and it was banned, and it was, and just even just the touch, and of course Ford's not the U.S. government, but they don't know any better. And so I think it's really, you have to be very careful about hurting the people you're trying to help, and I think that a lot of people are naive about that, and that's why a lot of the human rights organizations should be used as intermediaries to sort of tune into the nuance, or you're going to often get it wrong.
Yes.
Yes, Rafael Ramirez, I work in this business school. Richard and I were just commenting at the speed with which this landscape is evolving. And it would be very interesting to know how you find out how up to date you are with the landscape. How do you do it? And how do you suggest the rest of us do it?
Do you really know what's going on?
Yeah.
Well, I think the point, one point is, there's several different areas here, but on the security and technology side, it literally is constantly changing, so you should never assume that what you know is up to date. And I think that the only way to do it is really to use the social network to try to get the information that you need. But Twitter's a really great example. I mean, if you ask a question on Twitter and say, here's what I'm trying to do, what are the tools that we need, usually you'll get there are always people who are tracking things. And so one thing you should, and this gets to my stock and flow thing, I don't read TechCrunch or any of these things. To be very honest, I read very few blogs. Whenever I need any information, I tweet it and everybody links everything to me. And so the trick is really, again, and the way you create the network, and this is really important, is if you're doing something interesting and you're telling people about it, people follow you. And if people follow you, when you ask a question, they'll answer you. And so the best way to learn is to teach. And once you're contributing something and people say, hey, their project is really important, everybody will take their energy to make sure you've got the latest tools. And trying to get your head around the tools, you'll always fail. So that's my advice.
Anything to add?
Joyce points as very important thing in here is about the trust in the community, whether it's online community or offline community. I think the trust is a basic point that you can start sharing. Through Twitter, I mean, this is a really fast tool of sharing everything, every idea you pop in your mind, every observation you have in the day. And the more you share with other people and the more the trust you get from others, and the more effects, the sharing effect you actually create around your community. So that's the point.
Yes.
My name is Salil Baz from Sadat Association Egypt, and I want to share my experience with you as the most used tool, networking tool in Egypt is Facebook. Although it's not safety now, because there is movement in Egypt that called 6th of April movement. They make demonstration and they use the Facebook as a tool. And after then, security begin to monitor Facebook. But actually, as I'm founder member in political party in Egypt called the Reform and Development Party, we used Facebook to attract members. We have 2,000 members. We get them from Facebook as well. So it's the most used tool in Egypt. Thank you.
Thank you just for this glimpse into Egypt.
I make a comment also. The working theory right now about how the hackers broke into Google is that they analyzed Facebook and Twitter and social graphs of the targets. So the targets are very secure security people, but their friends aren't secure. And then what they do is they find these people, and they find the social the networks that they use, and they find the weakest network that they use, so online service, and they break it, right? Because they can brute force. And 99% of people use the same password on all the services. So then they log into their email. And right now, just another aside, PDFs have a security flaw. And you can open a PDF that has a virus in it, and your computer is completely owned. And so what they did was they would send PDFs to their friends, say, hey, take a look at this cool PDF, and they're coming from their best friends. And they open it, and their computer is owned. And they're now working very hard. I just saw a patch this morning to Adobe Acrobat, so hopefully they're working on it. But there are constantly these issues. And so one of the things, my point is, your social graph is actually a really interesting thing for both hackers and for governments. And I think one of the things you have to be careful about is you have to assume that people are going to be analyzing your social graph. And so, again, you just have to be mindful of that.
There was another question here. And then we come to you. Yes.
Hi, I'm Matt York from One Media Player Per Teacher. So we try to get Rich Media Files podcasts to teachers that are far off the internet. So you mentioned SneakerNet a little bit. I wanted to find out if you have any comments on how to formalize the SneakerNet. So are there any examples of where the SneakerNet is really becoming rich and robust, where people just don't have regular access to the internet?
And explain what it is for those who have never heard of that word.
The SneakerNet is when you use your sneakers as the network.
Right.
So you download data from the internet, put it on a piece of flash memory, and then you walk someplace with your sneakers.
Perfect definition. Joy.
And that's how most of the stuff from Burma got out, was sneaker nets and coordination by prepaid cell phones. And it's still the primary vehicle for human rights organizations. And they have some, if you go online, you can find USB sticks that look like keys. You can, there's all kinds of really tricky USB stuff. And that's by far the most effective way to get things out, because just electronic transmission, you have to assume that people are going to get it, especially if you're trying to upload video. You're like this big lighthouse, you know, and so you really don't want to encourage human rights workers or people at risk to try to upload stuff to YouTube and stuff like that. Get it out on a USB stick, get it to somewhere safe, and have somebody qualified upload it. Really don't get these people in these positions of risks. And even USB keys, you know, these are also now becoming, you know, they know what can fit in it. So at border guards and stuff like that, they'll always be looking for them. And so you should be very stealthy about it. But I think what's important is there's a whole bunch of real-world, on-the-ground, physical stuff to get. And I guess I'm focusing a little bit more on people in repressive regimes than other social entrepreneurs. But that sneaker net is the key element. That's the last mile that gets the stuff out of these places. And anyway.
Yes.
Hi, my name is Jigar Mehta. I'm a journalist with The New York Times. And oftentimes we are listening to blogs, Twitter, Facebook, and whether it's Iran or China and whatnot. But a problem that we always have is it takes us a while to verify, and sometimes we never do, the user of the post. What are some best practices that we could use to, as journalists, to verify that the information we're getting is accurate?
I can handle that quickly. I mean, I was in Egypt last month training citizen journalists and mainstream journalists on how best to use social media. And to see them work together is, you're over there, so I want to look at you. Seeing them work together is really important, because I think that really is the future of the news industry, in that you can't be everywhere, and so you're going to start relying on citizen journalists more and more, but you also start, and that's why I also mentioned this, the issue of anonymity, and this was especially true in Iran after the elections. You can't tell who the person is who is tweeting or blogging. And as a way of supporting people in Tehran who are being rounded up simply through their tweets, many people across the world started listing their location as Tehran. So as a journalist now, if you go on Twitter and look for Tehran as a location, people all around the world are saying they're in Tehran to protect those who really are in Tehran. So my advice to you quickly would be that you can't, first of all, guarantee that the person online is the person online unless you know them personally, but to develop a network of people on the ground. I spoke on a panel last week at Johns Hopkins with an Iranian cartoonist called Nikhang Kausar, who's living in exile because he drew a cartoon of a cleric as a crocodile, Mr. Crocodile, he called him. And people wanted him to be executed. But anyway, his story was the way he guarantees what his sources on the ground are telling him, because he lives in exile in Canada, is that he has his own kind of network of citizen journalists that he knows personally. And just one example, he had one of those citizen journalists take his mobile phone and go to a source, anonymous source in Tehran, give him the phone and say, Nick wants to interview you. So that citizen journalist now became the link that told Nick, I know who this person is, without having to reveal who that person is. Do you know what I mean? So I think that mainstream journalists are going to start using citizen journalists on the ground more and more to create that link that we especially need to verify things.
And I'm sorry to suck up so much air, but just to riff on that, during the Iran election thing, Twitter became a virtual newsroom. The Daily Kos had reported that one of the politicians had been thrown in jail. I retweeted it. You know, Mohammed Namabeh at Al Jazeera had his person in Tehran give a call. The guy was still there. And then they updated it. We retweeted it. Daily Kos updated it. And then they had somebody listening to the radio in Farsi. And we're all working, vetting the sources. And so I think if you're kind of protective, I want my scoop, you know, the old sort of, you know, scoopy thingy, obviously that's going to be, it's not going to work. But if you look at the social media as your newsroom rather than your publication output audience, then suddenly it's a lot easier. And we do this all the time. My favorite pastime is debunking failed mass mainstream media things. And
full-time job.
It's not that the social media is it's actually the tool for vetting a lot of these things, because you can always find somebody local who will phone them up or who has a connection that can figure out whether, you know, like, this guy, does he really exist? Oh yeah, well I'm in the Lions Club with him in Rio, you know, and then you can triangulate, and usually it's a six degree thing. So really I think it's a changing of the mindset and thinking of it as a newsroom.
Right.
Julian.
I have a comment to add to this gentleman.
Oh, sorry, yes.
Actually, last week, there was a rumor on the Twitter, not really on the Twitter, but on the internet, and saying during the expo, all the foreigners who live in Shanghai have to carry their passport and not allowed to go out at 11 o'clock. And once this news was out, it was actually published by an online magazine. It's not even sort of citizen journalism. And it was spread around on Twitter, and everybody's questioning if it's really true. And then there's a lot of people actually going to the police station and confront with the police and to check with them if it's really true, and turn out to be it's a rumor. And people just start to comment on this and also spread around through Twitter saying this is not true and people should not spread this rumor anymore. So this is kind of a typical example that citizens actually take this responsibility to correct the inaccuracy in the major media.
Yeah.
Gillian Caldwell, formerly Witness, now One Sky on Climate Action. I have a question about social networks, whether it's Facebook or LinkedIn. I probably, like all of you, use those primarily in the context of my professional identity. And I often I find myself in a conundrum with respect to all of the kind of friend requests or LinkedIn requests. How do you think about that, the advantages or disadvantages of being liberal with respect to, you know, even in a professional context, how many friends you accept, oftentimes having no idea who these people are? What are some of the safety considerations, which may be different for each of you, the pros and cons, and how you kind of analyze and approach that?
Briefly. Mona, why don't you go first?
Okay. All right. I call myself a Facebook whore. I accept everyone's request. because it's really useful for work. I mean, I'm almost at the limit of 5,000 now, but the safety consideration became apparent for me last year when I got my first death threat. I'd never got a death threat before, and I'm very happy not to receive another one again. But I usually use it to say, you know, I'm going to be in this place. I will be talking here. And a way of meeting many of those virtual friends in the real world, because they really are incredible sources for me. I will, you know, crowdsourcing and all that stuff, I will put a link something on, or I will put a question on Facebook, and I will get dozens of replies, you know, and it's really useful for my work. So it's a very delicate balancing act, because you can't guarantee who those people are, obviously. And, you know, yesterday I attended this panel on fighting violence against women, and literally, as I was tweeting, I got this message, not connected to the panel, but from someone on Facebook, just to tell me simply that you are a whore. So these are the kind of considerations that, especially as a woman who travels and who has quite a visible face and you know, stamp, it is a consideration. But the professional benefits outweigh the dangers for me. And perhaps I'm a foolish optimist in that regard. But I find it an incredibly rich resource, and I try to expand it as often as I can.
Yeah.
Well, I accept most of the friendship requests. Only those few looks very suspicious, and I would just block them. I think it also depends on how you want to use the social media. And to connect with friends, of course, is nice. But, I mean, I use it more personally as kind of broadcasting tool to announce whatever I want to announce and share whatever I want to share. And gradually, the people who actually want to share things with you, they will float. They will actually float them from the water. And people who are just basically adding everybody just stay under the water. They will never actually come out. So I don't really mind to accept a lot of friendship, but I mean the real friends actually is the most circle of people.
Okay. I think it's getting harder and harder to have a delicate balance. You either go all out or none. And so I think if you don't use any of them and you retain a very, very private life, you can end up with very few Google results. But I think the worst is being kind of in between, because so this is not just with Facebook, but I at some point decided I'm going to become public, because what happens is I was getting attacked. My specific thing was I haven't graduated from college. I've told everybody I don't graduate from college. Somebody got it wrong in some conference brochure, and people started writing in newspapers that I had graduated from college, and then people started saying that I was lying about my... But the thing was that because I had my own blog, and that was the first result for my name, I could say, well, look, I've told everybody that I've never graduated from college, and I own the conversation about myself. So whenever anybody looked for it, they would get me first. Now, if I didn't have my life all online, and if it weren't for the fact that I had said hundreds of times on my blog that I'd never graduated from college, I'd look like a liar. But I think once you can get public enough, but you have to change your behavior. You have to stop doing anything that you would be embarrassed about people knowing about, and the thing is,
turn off your Wi-Fi now.
And just a warning: it's a lot less embarrassing if you tell the story yourself. And so my blog for the first couple of years was like going back and telling every single embarrassing story I could ever remember, but with all the context of why I did it and all this, assuming that it would ever eventually come up anyway. But once I kind of had this catharsis of just about every single thing that I've ever done, that's including everything embarrassing, is all online. And now I have a lot less to use. You still get people coming after you for certain things like that, and some people, the benefits outweigh the costs. It's a huge cost to become completely transparent. Right. But unless you're willing to do that, there's a huge risk. And I think that right now we're in this point where the tools are so poorly done. It reminds me of pollution, right? What your privacy is just all out there. It's like nuclear waste. It'll never go away. And you really, really have to have like a zero impact man strategy if you're going to try to retain your privacy. And so for me, it's control the conversation about yourself is why I'm sort of promiscuous about my connections.
Okay. I wanted to bring in a couple of additional people. We have another about 17, 8 minutes to go. Because these tools are also for us social entrepreneurs are also useful for finding people or for finding money, for example, people to collaborate with, capital markets to plug into. And we have two people here that I wanted just to hear for a couple of minutes each about what they do. Peter Deitz is the founder of Social Actions and the co-creator of the Social Entrepreneurs API, which is a database of social entrepreneurs in an attempt to identify and qualify social entrepreneurs and basically give them a label of quality. Let's say like that. I'm forcing the line here. I know, Peter. But explain us what you do and how you use these tools for that.
I'll be very brief. Basically, what we're hearing here is that tech-savvy social entrepreneurs find ways to use and maximize the social web pretty much out of necessity. And the funders of these social entrepreneurs are still, for the most part, scratching their heads about social media and how it can, you know, transform their own work and help them drive attention to the social entrepreneurs they fund. There is this exception, though, which is a project with seed funding from Peary Foundation and really championed by Jill Finlayson of Skoll Foundation. It brings together all of the Skoll Fellows, all of the Schwab Foundation for Social Entrepreneurship Fellows, the Draper Richard Foundation Fellows, PopTech Social Innovators, and the Civic Venture Purpose Prize winners into an open source, highly distributable, highly decentralized database of vetted social entrepreneurs. Its premise is that by making this information available, social entrepreneurs can be found by their peers, by funders, by the media. It's a really kind of compelling example of funders walking the walk of collaboration, but also finding a way to use the social web in a way that's very consistent with what we've been hearing: open source, decentralized, polychronic. I'm still figuring out what that means. If you go to socialedge.org, click on the social entrepreneur search link under features, you can see an example of a widget which packages and presents this information about the vetted social entrepreneurs. And just two really quick points. What's interesting is that this project is transforming the funding organizations of social entrepreneurs from simply funders and support providers into magnets for people who want to support, draw attention to, and learn from social entrepreneurs. I would say the future of social entrepreneurship is peer-to-peer, open source, powered by the social web, and there's a huge role for trusted referrers, intermediaries, to connect social entrepreneurs with people who can support them.
Are you planning to expand it, so to add other people?
Vetted programs that offer fellowships and awards to social entrepreneurs are welcome. It's the participating organizations who make that call on whether additional orgs that should join or welcome. So the next few weeks, we're adding Ashoka Canada, the Global Social Benefit Incubator out of Santa Clara University, and Equine Green has stated that they want to participate. TED Fellows are... The TED program is invited, very welcome. And we simply need spreadsheets or feeds of this data. Technology is not complicated. We're dealing with the transformation of the culture of social entrepreneurship towards collaboration, and that's where I think there's some hesitancy to come together around projects like this.
Network of networks. And then another thing that you can do is try to plug into capital markets. And in some regions, you need to create them, actually, because they're not there. So Dean Hand is from South Africa, and she's the CEO of Greater Good, and they're working exactly on this, exactly on developing the infrastructure for capital markets. Tell us how to do that.
Okay, so the South African Social Investment Exchange is effectively modeled on financial capital markets, so effectively creating platforms for social capital markets to exist. And out of that was born the whole concept of Nexi, which is really the idea of trying to use technology in a way that actually doesn't limit anybody to have access to it, allow any organization or anybody that is looking for investment opportunities to be able to list themselves on it and to actually facilitate that trade between investing organizations and those that are looking for investment. So a stock exchange, as it were, that allows online trading, that all it does is actually set what the listing criteria are, effectively as a financial market would, but facilitate that through trading, clearing, transactions that might happen on that particular platform.
Who's the typical organization that should be in that exchange?
You mean both from an investment point of view and so, I mean, social entrepreneurs, you know, and that looking for any form of funding, whether that means, when I say funding, I'm talking more in terms of investment. They might be looking for capital, that might be patient capital, might be debt, might be equity, might be anything that they would be looking for. Debt, you know, grant that might turn into equity later on, something, all sorts of hybrids of models. In fact, we've listened to a lot of them this week. But on the investment side, it could be organizations, foundations, asset managers. Certainly a lot of the financial markets are very, very interested in how it is that they might, in fact, actually plug into this. The idea behind it as well is to also keep it very, very close to financial markets. That doesn't mean to say that what one's trying to do is try and massage social entrepreneurs into a financial market per se, but rather try and change the thinking around a financial market as to how a financial stock exchange might work to actually incorporate a different form of investing using online technology and platforms that actually make it simpler and easier. Yeah.
I wanted to bring in these two elements because we've been speaking a lot about freedom of speech, of course, and these kind of things, but just to point out that these tools are used exactly the same way for very different goals. We have a question here from Victor and one up here then. Yes.
Actually, it's not really a question. It's more, you know, adding to this. You know, let's not forget I think it was the first online platform, the first online community for social entrepreneurs by social entrepreneurs, SocialEdge at socialedge.org. I like to plug this in because let's not actually forget that there is already spaces over there. But what is also very interesting is what you're talking about, because we know that we cannot cover the whole field. And that's why, you know, there's, of course, other API, other applications. There's always a limit with technology. And we know it very well at SocialEdge because it's a fairly intensive community, you know, with a lot of people commenting, asking questions, and blogging, and uploading videos, and we have podcasts and everything. But we know also that we don't reach out to Africa that well, except for East Africa, maybe South Africa. We don't have any traction in South America. So the fact is there is a need for many more platforms out there. So this is all good that we are
and to link to them among
exactly. Them. And by the way, I would like to mention something because it's very rare. The whole SocialEdge team is here. And we usually we never travel together because it's too risky. You never know.
There is no travel this week anyway. We are all blocked here. Here. Oh, you want to respond to this? Quickly, yes.
Very, very quickly, I just think it's important, and maybe the one of the lessons on Africa, which doesn't really have a very high internet penetration, what is very high is cell phone technology, extremely high. And so one of the things that is developing very, very quickly are all kinds of transaction banking platforms that actually connect into internet platforms very, very well. And I think watch that space. It's probably going to happen much more quickly than one even realizes.
There's a question here.
I want to add a few comments to
this.
I'm a regular reader of Social Edge and also Change.org, and actually I'm a big fan of somebody sitting there. but I think that most of the people who can't speak English, they simply can't access your website. And then in this case, we'll have to depend on this 15,000 translators who are active and trying to help people and breaking this language barrier. So maybe you can just I can put you in contact with these people and translate the content.
I actually wanted to bring Joy into this as well, because you mentioned the issue of translation and automatic translation, automatic plus human and human. We have some experience with that at TED as well. We translate and subtitle the talks in 70 languages now. What kind of comment do you want to add to this?
So I think EN, which is what I think you're talking about, yeah, is one of the best that I've seen. They've translated my books. They've got a really good workflow of first-line editors that edit those editors, and quality control. And there's a lot of really great experiments that are using, but it's a combination of tools in the community and also writing things that are easy to translate. So that was one of the big sessions that we had at Global Voices with the translators, is how can you write in ways that are easy to translate? Creative Commons, I know Change.org uses Creative Commons, I think is really also really important, because I mean, China isn't as big an issue about copyright, but in a lot of countries you can't translate. Translating is creating a derivative work, so it's transformation. So you need the right to do that. By using a Creative Commons license, you're giving permission for people to do that. But you should definitely talk to the translators, because I think understanding how they translate, one thing is making small chunks rather than big long things. There's a lot of ways to do writing in a way that's easier to translate, and it's a style that would be great for everyone to adopt.
Time for two more questions or remarks. Yes, one here and one there. Three, okay. Go ahead.
Hi there, thanks. A bit embarrassed to say some of the technological discussion went a bit over my head, so I'm hoping to apply some of the major messages that came out, which were around the openness and the transparency of where this landscape is shifting. So if you or anyone in the room can speak towards that message as applied to two communities that I think have traditionally been rather closed. One which was hinted at was the philanthropic and the foundation community, which seem to be quite closed, as well as the academic community that have based their intellectual property behind a closed network, and then 2.5 years later come out with something. So how can we embrace some of these tools to be more open source and more relevant and timely in the process?
Any comment?
I don't want to answer everything, but I have an opinion on it. So the academic community has a really fundamental business model problem, because I think that you needed universities and you needed academic publications to get the word out. They played a very, very important role. But in order to support that business model, we gave them a very unfair advantage, which was we gave all these institutions the copyright, plus we gave them the right to charge $18,000 for a subscription to the physics journal. Well, you don't need that anymore on the internet. And they don't pay peer reviewers, by the way, right? So the Public Library of Science, and there are a lot of organizations trying to create open textbooks and sharing, and there's a whole bunch of work that the OSI and others are doing about access to knowledge. But there's a huge kind of conflict between the institutions that provide tenure and do all this stuff. And this is something that we're providing the tools to enable that, but it really requires kind of a waking up of the academics themselves saying, wait, wasn't our role in the first place to disseminate knowledge and not to create these institutions that provide us security? And so it's not just the copyright part's pretty easy to solve once you get people aware that they want to share. I also find with foundations now, generally speaking, there's a couple of different categories of foundations, but a lot of the old school foundations still have, typically the grant officers are very risk adverse, and I think they're worried about putting money into things that may fail, and they don't look at the collaborative stuff. And I think a lot of the advanced thinkers now are saying, okay, well, now with the internet, you can get this organization to do this part and the geeks to do this part, and you can mash up a bunch of programs and create something that as a network is sustainable and interesting. And I think what you need to start doing is the foundations start, and the thing is, I think, like, I give talks to groups of, like, grant-making organizations, and they're all kind of scared about being pitched by little ideas that they don't understand and stuff like that. And so I think one of the other things that would be great to do is, and different groups have these meta-organizations, is to educate foundations and the program officers about this idea of collaborative networks and funding groups. And the other thing is that development officers in nonprofits also have this kind of old-school thinking that says, okay, well, it's cannibalizing. So if I work with an organization that's similar, we're going to be going after the same grant. So it's going to require sort of an opening up on both sides, saying, you know, funding networks is great, and also as a development person, working with other organizations is great, and sharing is really important. And this, David Weinberger has this great phrase, which the internet is small pieces loosely joined. And it's about groups working together instead of creating these huge monolithic institutions. And again, this gets back to flows versus stocks and stuff like that. But it's a philosophical change, and I think you kind of have to change one program officer at a time. But I think it's also about making some success stories.
Two last remarks, very, very briefly. Let me just take the last question. Yeah. So,
very quickly, the theme is collaboration. It's difficult enough to collaborate with sort of non-virtual organizations. I mean, I'm amazed by how many people, you know, on the internet are doing basically the same thing, or in almost competitors to each other for the same space. How do you get collaboration in the virtual network business? And how do you get sort of people doing the same thing to actually come together to create a more powerful space than people trying to own each space individually?
Do you
want to
go first, Lou, because you want to say something before?
Yeah. Well, I actually recorded that question. I can go first.
Okay. Go ahead.
The simplest thing is the aggregates that many bloggers have created just to put themselves together on the same page so that they can find each other. But it's, you have to go back and forth. It can't just be virtual, because the whole power of it is that it can bounce back and forth. And I mean, the example I gave from Lebanon about the citizenship law, it gained traction because it had resonance both in the virtual and in the real world. The young woman from Egypt mentioned the political movement launched in Egypt. A wonderful example of collaboration that involved both real and virtual came in Egypt in 2006, when there was mass sexual assaults on women in downtown Cairo, which to this day the Egyptian government denies ever happened. But bloggers who were there took pictures of what happened, posted it online, and then that it was picked up by the international and the independent media, and then an Egyptian women's rights group in Egypt launched a survey on sexual harassment and groping on the streets of Cairo, and then all these other groups came up on Facebook that basically have young men and women who go out on the street and kind of canvas and talk to people and say sexual harassment is bad. And now that has all led to, because of all that collaboration, the Egyptian parliament is about to discuss a law that will A, define sexual harassment in public spaces, and B, criminalize it, because we don't have a law against it. So and that's by way of just saying that you have to have virtual and real world collaboration, and it is happening. I understand what you're saying about the duplication, but I see that a lot of people are filling in the spaces that we also need too.
Anything to add?
And it's a lot easier to find out whether somebody else is doing the same thing you are. So before you start something, look to see if somebody else has done it. And so the hackerspace credo, search for a hackerspace in your own town. If you find one, join it. If you don't, start one. And I think that's kind of a good motto for movements in general.
I want to give an example of Qi Fang, who is giving this providing this platform for micro financing. And the CEO told me that there is no way for them to compete with any banks or credit companies who are in the real world. Their only choice is working with them as a partner and providing service to actually connect them with the people who have these needs. So that's my answer.
Last question, very short, please. Yes, and a short answer.
I'm going to rush it. Marcus Eddy from Equal Media. Thanks very much. I have a question. When you're not a social media celebrity, or you don't have the time to build that celebrity status up, how do you democratize impact for most people out there who have things that they care about but aren't necessarily domain experts and don't have the time to build celebrity status to get it out with these very powerful social media tools?
So I think there's like an interesting long tail effect. So each, this is more for blogging, but it's similar in Twitter, is every one of us has a little area of core domain. And so I'm doing Middle East, I do certain things. And we read people who really have no audience. And we amplify up and we amplify up. And Lisa's here from Boing Boing, which is one of the biggest amplifiers. So I think of them as the guitar amp. We're like the guitar players. And then we go mine for stuff. And so, you know, like some of the bloggers really scour little bulletin boards and mailing lists and stuff like that. So if you have something interesting to contribute, even if you have no audience, somebody will find that. And so the best example is when the George Bush 60 Minutes thing. When Dan Rather put up a letter that was apparently written National Guard, somebody said, huh, that doesn't look like the format that the National Guard used. And then somebody said, hey, that font doesn't look right. Hey, this is Microsoft Word. And then somebody said, hey, and by that they debunked that letter. But it was a bunch of things that if they had happened in little bar rooms, would never have connected together. And these weren't really famous celebrity people. These were just random people who had written on a bulletin board here, written on a bulletin board there. But the bloggers sort of picked it up, and all that information surfaced very quickly. And so I think there's a very good mechanism of amplifying the voices of people who don't have an audience. As long as you put it up somewhere where a few people are reading, within a few days it'll find its way to the mega blogs.
And let's keep that as the word of the end. So a round of applause for the three speakers. And thank you to you for coming. Lunch is served. I think it's the same mechanism as yesterday. So enjoy the day. Thank you.